Okay, it's about 6 o'clock, so we are going to go ahead and get started. John is from Fisher and Phillips, and he has so graciously agreed to speak to us. He has several topics he wants to talk to us about, but I was interested in this one, so this is the one we chose. So, without further ado, thank you, John, and I'm going to mute my mic.
All right. Well, it's good to be here. I hope everybody can hear me okay. But the topic here is employee hiring, firing, and discipline, and that's really the heart of what employers do. Those decisions are critical. There's a lot invested in people's personal lives and their employment, so they're going to fight back if you're unsettling their livelihood. And yet, on the other hand, you have to run a business, and there are certain criteria that are necessary in order to do that effectively. And so there's this tension that's always going on between employers and employees, and this has been going on for hundreds of years. So it's nothing new, but, you know, California, we've been tackling that in California's own unique way. And as a nation, we have a history of being a little on the softer side with employees than in many countries. So we take the leadership on that, but there is a downside to it, and there's a certain amount of inefficiency that we tolerate. But employers do have rights to insist on standards, and we're going to be talking about that, about the different ways of approaching those issues. Now, one of the things that we have that is kind of like the overriding principle that we're dealing with is the principle of at-will employment. And that's really quite a foreign concept across the world in many different places. I always remember the story about somebody in Saudi Arabia. An employer was working one day. It was a manufacturing outfit. And then they came to work one day, and then there was a completely different person showing up on the machine than was there before. And the person announced that he had purchased the job from somebody else. And so this new person was there and never tested, never applied, just showed up. And so the whole idea of employment was one of a really rigid contractual arrangement that not even the employer itself had control over. Obviously, it's not that way here, but there is a notion of, you know, only being able to terminate for cause, which is pretty much prevalent in many parts of the world. The law in most states is that employees, however, can resign or be terminated for good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all without prior notice. And the employee as well is able to make that decision as well. So, you know, you're free to come and go as you will. However, there are statutory protections that overcome that presumption of employment at will. California has a presumption of employment at will, right built into the statutes. But there are certain presumptions or protections that overcome that, and that's really where we start varying from this open-ended at-will employment. One, of course, as you all know, is Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and there's similar state anti-discrimination acts. You know, California always comes to the party, for sure, in situations like this. And there's just a myriad of laws, and then superimposed on those laws are anti-retaliation laws, of course, as well. Then there's the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, which prohibits discrimination against those over the age of 40. And California has its own similar protections. We have the Americans with Disabilities Act, protects discrimination against persons with physical or mental disabilities. California, you know, has a more expansive definition or protection where you only have to be limited as opposed to substantially limited from engaging in the major like activity of work before those rights are triggered. So it's especially difficult in California. And there's the Family and Medical Leave Act, prohibits discrimination against employees who take protected family or medical leave, came out during the Clinton era. And California passed its own version, which is slightly more protective. And then we have the Employee Polygraph Protection Act, prohibits involuntary use of polygraph and discrimination against employees based upon refusal to be polygraphed. And that's probably kind of like a no-brainer because polygraph tests themselves are not all that reliable due to our science on that. Okay, Then six, we have the Occupational Safety and Health Act. It prohibits retaliation against employees who complain of unsafe working conditions, which of course has come into play with the COVID situation. We have public policies that overcome the employment at will. We have, there can be a myriad of statutes under state law. California is not the only one that does this, but there are other states that pass their own specific laws that overcome the presumption of employment, that provide certain entitlements not be infringed. There's a constitutional provision or regulation that may be involved. There's a right to privacy, for example, embedded in California law. Now, how that interfaces with California law will depend upon the facts and circumstances. Employees reporting of unlawful conduct, such as safety violations, discrimination, fraud, and wage and hour violations. So anyway, we have all these situations that come up in work and we can make promises to people. We can make assessments to people. We can give them feedback over time, which is often used in lawsuits as evidence that there really wasn't an at-will relationship contemplated, but it was rather a secure position that they could not be terminated from without cause, and that cause becomes another issue. So, and there's employers that have progressive discipline policies that say, well, we're going to give you a write-up, first verbal counseling, then a write-up, and then if you get two write-ups, you're suspended, and then on the third write-up, you're fired. So this is kind of a ladder. You start introducing that and enforcing it rigidly, then it creates this expectation of something other than at will that either party can exercise immediately if they want. Handbook or policy statements guaranteeing fairness of due process can sometimes be used against you in litigation. Interviewer or supervisor comments assuring, secure future employment, offer letters and things like that. I joined a company one time, a Fortune 500 company, where the person told me, you don't have to worry, just stick with us and you got a great future, just things like that. Although, something like that standing alone may not necessarily, help you in the end. I mean, it really has to be something typically more substantial than that, but we would obviously recommend that you don't make such open-ended comments because they could come back to haunt you in litigation. Also, maybe if there are unrealistic evaluations, sometimes it's safer just to say that you're fully satisfactory and not just to make them happy, put a blazing performance in there that's really not objectively accurate, because then obviously it's going to look really shocking if the next day somebody's terminated with such a lot of praise. And of course, the employee is going to say there are certain reasons why the termination occurred and had nothing to do with their performance, because look at this great performance review. That's something that, always got to be careful about. There could be written contracts or guarantees of employment. Many industries, have that. Teachers' unions have teaching contracts that are, year to year, and many of those are terms that are relied upon. But absent that kind of thing, it's very important to have disclaimers in any type of compensation agreement that even though you're disclosing to them their terms of compensation, it doesn't mean that you are... let me get rid of these phones. I apologize. Okay. So if you're in an employment relationship and there's a situation where you guarantee somebody, I'm going to guarantee you, a certain level of commissions over a certain period of time, then what the employees sometimes conclude from that is that it's a guarantee not only of level of pay, but it's a guarantee of being employed through the guarantee period. It'll give you a 90-day lock on your commissions where you're going to get at least $3,000 a month. And if you get, one and two and $1,500, you're always going to get that $3,000 for the first 3 months. And so they think, well, that must mean that you're being nice to me about the level of pay, you must also mean that I'm going to be employed for that whole period as well. So there's typically disclaimers in contracts of employment that indicate that even though you might get a guarantee as to the level of employment, guarantee will not extend to the, it won't defeat employment at will. All employment at will tells you is that while you're employed, you'll be promised a certain rate of pay, because every employment agreement, whether it's in writing or not, has an implied rate of pay. And now we know it's required, because under the Wage Theft Protection Act in California, you have to disclose that rate of pay in the beginning of employment. So there's no more, you know, waffling around about that. And so if they do have a guarantee, you still need to make clear that there isn't, it's still an at-will arrangement. So how do you... Well, how do you like that? Almost sound like a shotgun, huh? There's all these different protected categories. And, you know, these are just examples of some of those protected categories. Age, race, national origin, ancestry, religion, military duty, sexual orientation, pregnancy, marital status, disability, and gender. There's a lot of these categories out there that we have to take into consideration at all stages of employment, from application through through termination. Often, you know, there's something that we call a discrimination formula. You know, either the reason given for discipline was untrue, or the true reason for the discipline was discrimination. And discrimination is considered to have been a reason if it was a motivating factor. So all those things, you know, come to play when you do an investigation, when you defend, when they initially might send you a charge from Department of Fair Employment and Housing, or the EEOC. There's this period of time in which you respond with information, and they're going to be trying to track down these issues. Sometimes you find out specifically what the issue is about. Sometimes they kind of hide the ball, and then you get surprised later on that there's more to it. But you know, that's why you need to do a thorough investigation on these types of claims. You need to identify the employee's protected categories before you are, you know, dealing with a particular employee, so you can be extra cautious. Age, race, etc. When checking protected categories, you find out if the employee has made complaints or taken leaves of absence, because all those things can come into play in the drama of what they're alleging occurred. And sometimes the most unusual things can come up, like, you know, somebody ran into somebody else's car in the parking lot, so they either lost their job or they were demoted because they weren't driving safely. And so later, you know, they come back and say, well, I complained on a certain date about the parking lot being dark, and you're, you know, retaliating against me for making that complaint. You're trying to find the first reason. And so I hit somebody in the parking lot. I told you about that dark parking lot. So, you know, things can become really complicated because they have an attorney helping them, you know, craft a reason that for their termination that's other than the obvious. Okay, so what's important to do is to find out what has been done in similar situations in the past, and also consider whether any other employees currently are in a similar situation. Okay, and then just compare the protected categories of current and former employees in similar situations. So you don't want to. You have to be consistent, for one thing, and you don't want to take any action that will leave you standing with no explanation other than the fact the person's in a protected category and you treated them differently than other people. That is a bad situation. Determine if you can distinguish leniency in similar situations. Say there was somebody else in a parking lot that had an accident and ran into somebody else in the company parking lot. Why didn't you terminate them? Well, it may be that the person you terminated hid the fact that they even had an accident, and they hid it and obscured it, and they engaged in other actions trying to cover their tracks, and which was contrary to company policy. And so, you know, you try to build your case in that regard. What makes your case different so that you can show that you did have legitimate non-discriminatory reasons? Now, of course, having as many well-articulated reasons on the termination report, you don't have to put your report in the termination notice, but I mean, the bullet points as to the basis for termination, that can sometimes help you, because if any particular bullet point winds up being a little faulty, then if there are other backup points that are, you know, incontrovertible, then you still might be able to save your situation. So you just document why the current scenario is different than other non-disciplined scenarios, which is something you're always going to have to account for. Or you do something to clean the slate and hold back on, more severe discipline. I mean, there's a lot of situations that may come up that you'll have to explain. So let's talk about documenting and discipline and discharge. This is a real important stage because it has often been said that, you know, if it's not documented, it never happened. That's not literally true because a witness statement is evidence, okay? Something that a witness sees is evidence. Now, but it's evidence that you can discount because with a living person, always can change because of self-interest or because of whatever. They might have an agenda or whatever. So that's why live witnesses are always a little shaky, unless you can get somebody who's going to be viewed as being reliable no matter what. And it might be somebody who has every reason to be angry at the company. Say they were fired themselves, but yet on the witness stand, they'll talk about how fair the employer was in many situations, and which you sometimes get a gift. It really helps you, but don't count on that good news being available. I think you need to count on the documents speaking for themselves. Martin Luther once said, he once said, there's nothing worse than a wicked book because it can't repent. And I guess I thought that was kind of a funny statement to make, but I have seen him quoted on that. What does that mean? Well, if you look at it, if you have a book, if you have something in writing, it is what it is, right? There's something that's fixed about a document. So it looks like we have a little background there, a little background noise. Somebody might need to mute. But a document is fixed. A document can tell you when something occurred in time. A document can suggest what somebody was thinking at a particular time, what their motive was at a particular fixed point in time. And, you know, documents are very, very valuable. And so it's important that we do that. And there's many different ways of documenting evidence. So in documenting discipline and discharge, you first have to decide which path you're going down toward termination. And sometimes you don't have a whole lot of notice. If it's a misconduct termination, of course, investigation is the key. Somebody made a proposition to an employee in the hallway, you know, after work. You know, we've had several of those, or in the parking lot or whatever. And so the real key is that if you find out that they did that, in many cases, If it's a severe enough what they did, then the first offense will be a termination. There won't be any, you know, you're not going to waffle around with that because you don't want to be seen as an employer who puts up with that stuff. Okay, it's very offensive, and people that are in vulnerable positions don't want to be exposed to that going to work. So when you have somebody who makes an allegation like that, that something happened, that somebody treated them in a certain way, then the only thing barring you, if what they alleged is true, that you would terminate somebody for that, then the only thing keeping you from terminating that person is to establish through an investigation that it was more likely than not that they did it, or, you know, it was believable. I mean, you're not conducting a criminal trial. You don't have to establish it beyond reasonable doubt. It's not a criminal trial. You just have to have a reasonable faith, a reasonable belief based upon the evidence that you collect, that the misconduct that was alleged did actually occur. And there's been a few key cases, if we have a chance to talk about them, we will talk about what level is needed, but what really is important that you give that person a chance to tell their side of the story too, because then it could look like a biased investigation if you don't have a complete evaluation of everybody's position. The next thing in the category two type of discipline and possible discharge would be performance terminations. In performance terminations, fair notice is really the key. There has to be fair notice. And because typically performance, there's a lot of subjectivity as to whether somebody acceptably does something or not. And there could be multiple examples of people doing the same thing and not getting terminated for it. So you have to have all your ducks in a row when somebody's performance is leading to termination so that the basis, the objective basis for the performance is clearly laid out. So they have a chance to take corrective action. That helps prevent, you know, retaliation claims, discrimination claims, and a number of complications. Okay, so these are the two main type of terminations, misconduct terminations and performance terminations. Let's talk a little bit now about misconduct terminations. Here, there's a little bit of an acronym that's been used here. Code has been violated. Now, code's just a magic word that could mean a lot of things. Rules, the law, safety, whatever. It's just a rule has been violated. Leave of absence for the accused. If somebody is accused of doing that and harmed another employee and they're complaining, then you don't want to keep that employee in the environment if the accusation is one of violence or something that is significant enough to where you really don't want that person around in your operation. So give leave to the person who's been accused. You don't have to, you know, whether it's paid or unpaid will, in many cases, depend upon whether the person is salaried exempt or not. They've already worked in the week, or it may depend upon if they're non-exempt. It may depend upon just simply the seriousness of the situation, whether they are responsible for it. So all these things have to be, and you have to come up with a fairly cohesive policy as to these kinds of leaves. If it turns out that there was some fault on the part of the person who was that left or that was suspended pending investigation, then it could just stand as a suspension and won't ripen into termination based upon your investigation. That sometimes that's the outcome as well. In which case, whether it's paid or not will again depend upon what kind of employee they are, and you'll have to come up with your policy on that. You cannot, as a matter of law, partially pay somebody under California state law in a week in which they've worked when you are the one that caused them to leave through a suspension. You know, so some people, you know, like to just wait until the week starts and suspend them for the whole week, you know, so that they can lose a whole week's pay. You know, there's a lot of ways of doing it, but just, you know, remember to have a clear path before you. Get an explanation from the accused. I indicated that previously. If you do your whole investigation, never once even talk to the person, that's not going to look good. And it's going to look like you didn't give the person a fair shake. And there's clear indications that if you actually did that, that the liability could in some cases be huge for wrongful termination. If you just had simply got the explanation from the accused, he would have been vindicated completely. And the evidence would have led that way. Well, you know, that's really going to be a problem. It doesn't matter how great the witnesses are against the person. They might have even had a vendetta against that person. And then you get affidavits from witnesses or declarations or statements, because those can be used to impeach the person who claims to have not done it. Then there's non-discriminatory decision at the end after you've weighed all the evidence. And again, it's a tough process. You have to guard the person's privacy to a degree. People who have no reason to know about it should not be told about it. And many people lose their jobs in companies, and everybody else, they're surprised when they're gone. They didn't know anything about it. So sometimes that's the best way. And many times that's the best way, because the reasons for letting them go have not been made public or open within the workplace. Now, by contrast, let's talk about a performance termination. With a performance termination, again, the person needs to have notice of that issue, notice of the problem. Okay. And sometimes, you have to think it out before you give them that notice, because remember, if the real intent is that they improve, you have to clearly lay out what needs to improve. It could be partially attitude. Just be careful how you formulate that, because attitude can sometimes be a reason given for somebody vindicating their rights, so to speak, engaging in protected conduct. It's easy to say, oh, the person has a bad attitude. Really what they're complaining about is that you cheated me out of overtime. And so how dare you say I had a bad attitude? I was just talking about the problem. Okay. So you need to be careful how you articulate it whenever you talk about attitude and things like that, that are kind of on the soft side. It's really very concrete, then that's something else altogether. Explanation of how to improve. Okay, they need to be given some kind of instructions or detailed path to improve. And this takes a degree of discipline on the part of the employer as well. I don't know that it's always a good idea to say, we give you 30 days to improve, because if you just overlook stuff over the whole 30 days and then let the person go beyond 30 days, the presumption is, well, he must have been doing pretty good if you didn't let him go. And another situation that always seems to come up in performance terminations is the person, they've like a 3, 4, 5 year employee. And my question sometimes to clients are, why is he still employed? Has he been doing this before? Oh yeah, he's always done this. Well, what is so special about this situation that you're now making it an issue that you want to terminate the person for this? And they'll say, well, you know, it just came down to, he was challenging my authority. And, you know, there he is once again, he's not listening to me. He's not improving in this, that, and the other area. And that's simply not going to be good, especially if you just got back from a family leave. And then you're suddenly, you know, increasing the scrutiny on issues that the person completely got away with before. And unfortunately, sometimes this is what you're faced with, because when somebody goes on a family leave, it's only then that you find out the stash of unpaid invoices in the front of their desk. It's only then that you find out all the stuff that they haven't done. When you put somebody new in the position, eager to have the position permanently, and so they will do a very good job of laying you out a bullet point list of all the things this particular person has not been done, so that they won't deserve to come back. And so that they will basically, as a conquest, they will take over their position. So this does happen. And sometimes it's absolutely realistic. It does happen that way, where the person did a lousy job, but management didn't do their job staying on top of accounts receivable and other things to verify that things were being done as they should be done. So be careful about that and make sure that you go about that in a methodical way. Assistance to improve, people are our most valuable asset. I mean, I've had situations come up where somebody just had to terminate somebody. They just had to terminate somebody. They were angry. It was a personality thing. So I got down with the people and I talked to them in very detail about this person's performance. And I'll be darned if they were like one of the very top performers. And as we talked through it and as the emotions settled down, I told the person, do you really want to fire this person? And they said, well, you know what? I really don't. And this is somebody who wasn't doing the misconduct stuff. This is just somebody who, very high performer, high level, with these high performers, they, you know, have personality issues. You know, these high performers are, they're A personalities, for lack of a better word, and sometimes they can be a little bit abrasive. So sometimes that needs to be managed. If the employer did not manage it, but let the guy go around, like a prima donna, untouchable, because he's such a high performer, then you finally run into these morale problems and other issues, something that was never handled. That's going to be a problem. You know, performance has to be managed. That's what makes good managers. You get your arms around people. Talk about what it's going to take to improve. Let them know they're important, because they are important. I mean, some people are more important than others, I think, for sure. But if somebody has lasted for 3, 4, 5 years, either the management was really, really poor, and sometimes that's possible, nobody likes confrontation, or sometimes it's just that there wasn't enough attention placed on what's expected, and the counseling process is what helps that happen. Number one, you decide before even starting the counseling progress, where do we want this to end up? Do we really want to let this person go? Is he really that bad? Because everybody is going to have deficiencies and weaknesses. That's part of being a human being. And if you look at many people who are high performers, you'll see that they've bounced around every 2 to 3 years from company to company. And they're all really good companies, because they were impressed with their performance, but they brought the same defect to every employer. So are you going to be the employer that finally gets to manage this person and finally gets to bring them around and help them to arrive to the next level. Sometimes it's happened, sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it's impossible, but we have to look at people as being valuable, valuable resources because they are. I mean, we can't operate without them. I mean, even the robots, you know, in many parts of the world, you know, they're replacing people with robots or, you know, monitor telephone calls. It's all recorded. It's really not very effective, but it does cut on costs. But it is something that the human element is really, truly, it's more of an art than a science. And we really have to be careful when we go about it. So assistance, what kind of assistance are we going to provide? If we have already made the decision that this person is worth keeping, we've already made that decision, then we are going to assist them. Okay. Now, if we've already made the decision to let them go, but we've botched it along the way, then, you know, maybe the assistance is going to be minimal. Maybe we're going to say, you should have known by now. You read that? Yes, I read it. Are you having an issue understanding A, B, C, and D? No, not really. But. Okay. And so it could be just more of the same excuses. A once good performer is now, you know, stalled out and they're not so good, or they never were good, or, you know, you got to kind of categorize them as to what their objective analysis is and then lay out a map. There's nothing wrong with making a decision. You're putting somebody on the termination track. You're just protecting it so that you have a good record. The person comes back from family medical leave. They have all these old checks stashed in their drawer. Okay. I think you can write that person up for that, especially if it's a relatively rare occurrence. If it's commonly occurring in other places, you don't write up other people for it. Obviously, you're going to have to be careful. Sometimes it takes a notice to everybody, and be careful about that as well. That, you know, that in doing internal auditing, you found that certain accounts are being neglected by everyone. Various degrees of neglect, but we want to stop this, and we want to get our accounting in order. So going forward, these are our new policies. Okay. Now, believe it or not, I've seen these come out and I've still seen the affected employees sue and then say that notice was done just to cover themselves because they really just wanted to use it against them. You know, and obviously their attorney helped them with that argument. But sometimes that's what you have to do. If you want to change the climate of your organization, sometimes you have to give everybody notice, not just that person who's performing in a bad way. But be sure to get legal counsel as to how to do that and the timing and everything else. So notice of the problem, explanation of how to improve, and then assistance in the improvement. We have one more, don't we? And the last one is time to improve. Okay, I said, be careful though, when you specify the time. That if it is a 30-day thing, and I'm not really a big fan of 30-day notices, you better stick with it. Otherwise, just say, we're going to circle back periodically sometime after such and such an event when we have our big event down there. I'd like to circle back and gather together our resources and talk again about where we're at on this. Okay. Some employers have what they call a personal improvement interview, the PIP or whatever they call it. And they use that as, and I've even had one employer, a humanitarian, he's an individual who, he's the owner, but he walks around all day and manages the place. I mean, kind of a rarity nowadays, you know. Often the owner hires a general manager and then fires him after they burn out, just hire another general manager, just a series of general managers that burn out. But no, this is the owner. He's there. And he has had general managers under him, but he's there every day. And when people get put on the personal improvement programs, then he's involved. And if they feel like they're being mistreated, there's an open door into his office. And he has a reputation of somebody saying, well, they were unfair in giving me this notice because. And he listens, and sometimes he agrees and he goes back to the general managers or other people underneath him and says, why don't you do a little better job about this, that, and the other? So the employees start trusting this guy on top because they know that there's an open door. Now, it doesn't always happen that cleanly, because once the guy on top always, basically overturns you, then you, a lot of these lower managers spending all their time just protecting their turf because they know they could be overridden, and they become people that don't really monitor others' performances because they feel like they'll be undermined in the end by the open door policy. So just be really careful that if you do have an open door policy, that it can be perceived as when you go to the guy on top, he may up, you know, the person, the last buck where it stops, is going to be one that's just and monitoring the fairness of it and will uphold many decisions to terminate. And I think that's important. If you do have that kind of a open door policy, be sure that it's fair, it's not undermining of other managers, and overall it's perceived as merely what it's meant to be, and that is just another appeal. It's not going to be by somebody who's wishy-washy on top that's going to, you know, make irrelevant all the hard work that's been done at other levels of the organization to deal with observable problems. Okay, so when should I write up an employee instead of just talking to them? Now, there's the phenomenon that occurs that I know in my old days as a manager, before I went to law school, I was actually a manager in a Fortune 500 company, and I managed union represented employees. Boy, was that fun. But I did. And, you know, and the union had some good things that it accomplished, but, you know, there was a lot of adversarial stuff too. And the moment I started documenting conversations I had with people, things that were they were doing, when I started documenting instead of just talking to them and back working with them that way, they became absolutely paranoid, and they started taking notes themselves, so that they had their notes and I had my notes. And I was young, you know, in my 20s when I was doing that, and so I had a lot to learn, you know, by doing things the wrong way. And I did actually learn by the time, after an 8-year career with that company, I did, you know, have it figured out a lot better. It was then that I decided to go to law school. I figured, hey, you know, it often ends up there. So I think I would enjoy being at the, you know, doing legal counseling to employers to help them with that, because I'd found certain things worked and certain didn't. So, but you have to learn the tension between being formalistic with people and writing them up and working with them cooperatively, not creating in them the adversarial relations that feed people getting unions in the first place. If you already have a union, then think about what can be done to work cooperatively with the union, if that's possible. Now, so many impairments or weaknesses that people have in their employment, you can confront them with it in a relatively innocuous way, depending upon what the nature of your ongoing relationships is with them. If you have emails that go back and forth a lot and you do a lot of counseling through emails, that sometimes helps, because the email is sometimes a non-threatening way, because it's just another way of communicating with people. And you can say in an email things that you sometimes can't get away with in a formal write-up. So, but there's pros and cons to emails. But should it just be limited to a conversation with somebody that's not readily memorialized in a document, an email or whatever, a text or whatever? Texts are really problematic because it's hard to preserve them, and it's crazy. So that's not a recommended way to communicate with people, through text. But sometimes it does turn out to the star bit of evidence in a case is that text message that somebody wrote. You mean I have to hire a disabled person in a text? So, you know, that's kind of hard. You know, that's an expensive text. Just put it that way, if the person's a manager, which is obviously mortifying to everyone when those things happen. But that's the degree of ignorance that sometimes is out there. You can't be in too big of a hurry when you, managers need to be trained. And they are now much better than they were before, but still some slip through. So talking to people is critical. Sometimes that's all it is talking, especially if you know that they're a good employee and there's good prospects, they're showing a degree of cooperation. If they're showing resistance right up front and you know that it's probably not going to work out, then you may just have to take more formalistic steps with the person. And at very least, when you do write them up at some point, if there were conversations that were had with that person along the way, those should be memorialized in a written write-up, so that all the historical events are captured, even though they're not all of them literally captured in a static document form. So again, it's really important what you want to do to the employee next. What is your next step? That's going to be critical. You want to fire them or write them up or whatever. It's going to depend. Remember, you got to, is this mere performance or is it misconduct? And I might as well bring that up now, that there are consequences between a misconduct termination and a performance termination. As many of you know, if somebody is terminated for misconduct and it's severe enough, they will be disqualified from unemployment benefits. Okay. But if the termination is found to be merely for poor performance, then the person gets unemployment benefits. But there's a lot of decisions that have been created, agency decisions that have been created around the distinctions between how do we know whether it's really truly discipline or whether it's for performance or whether it's really just a misconduct termination. And let me just tell you, one of the things that draws the line between the two is if you tolerated the person coming in late for 1 year or for 6 months or sometimes even for 3 months, coming in 3 to 4 minutes late, and then finally at the very end they did it again and you say, I told you, you're not listening to me, I'm terminating you for insubordination, you deliberately they might have told them the day before, hey, be sure to get here on time, you know, we need you, but the person comes in late, insubordination. So that's your reason that you put on your unemployment reason, and that's why you're opposing unemployment. Well, believe me, I've been to those hearings before. If it's something you've tolerated, they're going to look at it as performance, even though you couch it as misconduct because it occurred one more time on one occasion. You know, 200 instances of misconduct that never went, you know, responded to or that were never addressed as misconduct. Don't think that on the one occasion that you want best, that time it's going to be considered misconduct. You cannot tolerate a pattern of unacceptable conduct that you may, looking at that conduct in isolation, objectively look at it as misconduct, you know. But if they've been cussing you out every day for 1 year and getting away with it, it's going to be viewed as poor performance. Finally, you just couldn't take it. Okay, so be careful. Now, doing the write-up, you need to be complete with your write-up. Okay, don't leave things out. You might want to run it by somebody else who might also have information with you. Doing the write-up with somebody else can help you be complete on it, or the manager, if it's a direct supervisor and you're the next level up manager who's doing the write-up, be sure to get his complete input. Make sure you're not leaving anything out. Please avoid the vague language. We're trained in our society to be vague because part of that is to be politically correct and not be, you know, blunt with people and not hurt anybody's feelings. But sometimes you just have to be, you have to tell it like it is. Avoid threatening people. You can say any further recurrence could result in additional disciplinary action up to and including termination. That they're used to hearing that, and so it gives them notice that termination is a possibility. I've seen many cases where when the word termination was never raised as a possibility, although discipline might have been, the courts sometimes have considered it just was not as sharp as it could have been, that notice that's required to really fairly give them the opportunity, particularly in environments where they are viewed to have a right to employment that, you know, that cannot be breached unless it's for cause. And you get into those really, really tough arguments of fairness. Okay. You need to have a witness, like I said, get somebody who's a direct supervisor. Typically in a union situation, be careful, having a union represented person as a so-called witness, that's going to be a little problematic. You need to have somebody in management who's a witness when you're engaging in a management interview. Union will not take kindly to putting union people and crossing them with other union members. It's going to be a real problem. And that's the reason why typically in unions, if you are actually a supervisor, you are not going to be allowed to vote as being one of them because they don't want supervisors being one of them. they like that clear demarcation between management and supervised, and or management a person and those who are supervised by management. They're different. Okay. And you need to get a signature from the person. It may turn out that they don't buy into it. They don't want to sign it. And it's just, you know, they're used to being told that you don't sign a contract you don't agree to. And so they kind of use it here, even though in most cases you give them an opportunity to protest. And some people still will not agree to do it. And you just have to have the witness acknowledge that. Okay, so performance terminations, the sample warning facts, you know, your very friendly receptionist is about 5 minutes late every day, like I'd said before. She makes mistakes when transferring calls, and she makes quite a few personal telephone calls. The petty cash drawer is out of balance from time to time, and her skirts are a little short. So you got all these things, you know, building up here. The sample warning language. Okay, your performance is not acceptable for a number of reasons, including, now let me just put a caveat in there. Let's hope that she hadn't been employed too long where this had been tolerated. And often it is, especially when it comes to the wearing of short skirts. That's a very, very sensitive area, especially now more so than ever. So obviously you need to get legal counsel when jumping into those topics. But anyway, you are late for work on a regular basis. You work in a job where there is no room for tardiness. Okay, so there you go. This is not misconduct. This is not insubordination. You've tolerated it. You're late for work. The person's important enough that you haven't terminated that. It hasn't been, quote unquote, misconduct or whatever. It hasn't been, you know, failure to appear on a major milestone event or anything like that. But this is just the regular basis failing to appear to work. Now, you work in a job where there's no room for tardiness. It's important to state that, okay? You make a number of personal phone calls while you are working, which distracts you from doing your job. You know, and of course, discuss that with legal counsel because, you know, if you overhear those calls and it looks like they're talking to a particular person that might trigger, you know, privileges and things like that, you know, that, you know, it just muddies the water is all. But typically, if it's a personal phone call to their spouse or children or haggling with school situations, be careful with school situations because there are certain rights that they have to take leave and handle those situations. They may decide just to try to handle it on the phone instead of leaving the operation to go take care of it. And then they might remind you that, you know, they could have gone and asserted their right to handle the school issue, which is protected in California under certain defined circumstances, but yet they decided just to do it on the phone. Sorry, they didn't give you notice of that. They'll tell you in advance so that they can make the choices to whether to just let you go or whether you can just do it in the office. You know, it's amazing what kind of advice that people could get from attorneys to muddy this up a little bit. But you make a number of personal phone calls while you're working, which distracts you from doing your job. That should stand alone as objective. It's not really tied to anything unless the employee comes back and qualifies it. Employees are complaining that you make mistakes in transferring calls and your petty cash records are not always accurate. Okay. And this is just stating the reality. You know, if you don't include this in there, then it's not going to help you when you try, when you defend a case. Although there is certain defenses like after acquired evidence that you acquired only after they were terminated, but that's kind of a little bit more tricky than just having that reason available at the time and not calling it after acquired evidence, especially if you did actually know it at the time. I mean, you got to be completely transparent as to how you go about this to present your best case. At least the court is going to need to view you as being above board on this. Lastly, you need to be sure that your dress is appropriate. Be sure that your skirts are not too revealing. Okay. And again, like I say, this becomes a more problematic issue when these issues tended to be addressed, you know, years ago and upheld by the courts. There's a whole lot of stuff that's happened since then with dress being appropriate and inappropriate. Here we're just talking about skirts, you know, revealing and all that. And that's, you know, that's probably something that you can identify, especially if it's really clearly extreme. But there's other things like hairstyling and, you know, other things that might have a religious connection, all kinds of things in terms of the decorum in the workplace. You have to be really careful now more than ever and get legal counsel. If your performance does not improve, you will be subject to discipline up to and including termination. And that's kind of like the common language that's used. So getting these two things distinguished is really, truly the most important thing that you'll ever do in your job. And let me just say, too, that we do have a little bit of extra time. And I can tell you, I do a lot of my practice in the area of wage and hour law. And there's a lot of built-in protections to people who complain about certain aspects of their employment that is regulated by the California Labor Code. In the year 2000, there were 500 new labor code statutes that were introduced by Governor Gray Davis, the recalled governor of ancient times. He introduced these 500 statutes, and he has a reputation for not always knowing just what those statutes were. He just basically gave in to a lot of pressure and just passed these myriads of statutes. And why wouldn't he have done that? Well, it's because we had this daily overtime was eradicated for a very short time in California, where it was only over 40 hours a week for overtime, which was almost unheard of. How could you ever deviate from such a time-honored principle? So when the legislature came back to try to redo that and to try to reinstall these protections of daily overtime and everything else, they were ready to just unleash the world on employee protections. And so with those employee protections, we have a myriad of rights that employees have protection against if they complain about it, and then they subsequently are terminated. And those things are anywhere from meal and rest periods, depriving them of meal and rest periods, complaining about a manager, depriving them of rest periods, or pressuring them, or scheduling their work in such a way that they have no positive choice to really avoid working through lunch because they wouldn't get done, and all that. So there's a lot of barriers that come into play that you have to carefully lay out when you're considering whether the termination is going to be for misconduct or whether it's going to be for performance. If embedded in the drama of counseling with this employee are a number of things that that are problematic that occurred in the workplace, then the whole claim or the whole cause of terminating that employee actually just becomes something they're happy about, because then they can show that there's damages, there's lost wages, and all this stuff. And in some cases, there's punitive damages on top of that. And then, of course, this leads to other things. So be aware that in the wage and hour laws of California, that have become far more strict than ever, you have to be careful. Now, another reason why it's important to have things in writing, and how it could both help you and hurt you, so be careful what you put in writing, but it can help you and hurt you, is an employee has a right under California law to request a copy of their personnel file. And that contains everything in their file that is in their quote unquote personnel file. It contains everything they've ever signed. And believe it or not, they have a right to see any documents in the file that is related to workers' compensation leave or other medical leaves, which should be kept in separate files. There's a lot of protections, and you know, it's just more and more as to how you should be keeping information, what you should do with that information. All those things are critical, and that they're the things in there in that file are what the attorney uses to determine whether he wants to threaten the employer and try to get a settlement. Okay, so I don't want to suggest, by saying that it's important to have everything in writing, that you do a dump of stuff and put it in a file and call it a personnel file because you want to defend a suit, only to have somebody with access to that and be able to see that. Be careful what's in there. Be careful of job applications where you write at the top of the page, wow, looks like she's pregnant, or something like that, and you wind up not hiring her. It's on the application that nobody thought about it, that it's in the file. I mean, it's in the, and the attorney gets it, you know, and they just, you know, I had a plaintiff attorney one time tell me that when he sees a case, that it's an exciting, a positive case, he says he trembles with excitement when he sees things that help him in his case. And it's kind of obnoxious, but he admitted it. that he just trembles with excitement. Well, he's going to tremble. These kinds of people, these kinds of attorneys are going to tremble with excitement when they see these smoking gun type of erroneous documents in the personnel files. Employers are so busy that sometimes they just don't have time to go out there and audit their own files. And so their files are just ready to be harvested by employment attorneys who have a right. The employee has a right that they give to their attorney. They sign the authorization to request the documents, and then the attorney gets the documents, and then the attorney finds stuff. And it's really tough stuff. It really is. And what's in there could be very damaging. So that's why it's important to have legal counsel when you build an employee file, because it's discoverable. Things in there are discoverable. Be careful what you have in emails. Don't talk to other managers about employee situations that could later be disclosed. However, if an attorney is copied on that email to the other manager, when you're talking about an employee, that is certainly a way to help keep it within the scope of attorney-client privilege. But that there are situations, though, that even having the attorney's name on there may not always help you, particularly if the attorney had involvement in the case in one way or another that would allow somebody to say, we need to go beyond the privilege and get that document. Most of the time you can keep it from being disclosed, but it's problematic in some cases. But if you do copy an attorney on a correspondence, be sure that it's bona fide, be sure there's something to it, and that the attorney is not in the middle of the conflict, just getting advice on how to handle it. You forward something, an interaction from that attorney, you forward it to the attorney, and then, you know, copy the other manager and stuff like that. And, you know, those are ways that you can do it. But talk to your legal counsel about specifically how to go about what sometimes can be a very complicated investigation. So anyway, it's important. Remember, you got the two ways. You got the one way being performance. You got the other way being misconduct. It has consequences for unemployment. Don't be too much in a hurry to deprive somebody of unemployment if the facts won't really support it, because if they don't get unemployment, there are sometimes you'd rather them get unemployment, because if they don't have any income at all, they're going to want to sue you and get income that way. So it puts you in kind of a catch-22 sometimes. I've had employers once tell me that they were not going to oppose an unemployment claim because they did not want to put the employee in the situation of not having employment. They just simply would just let the employee's reason be there. Sometimes it's a bad reason, but it's not technically admissible in any other forum. Although, you know, it does come up as an issue sometimes in the middle of litigation. You know, why did you, oh, you got unemployment, huh? So anyway, that terminates what can be a very, very detailed topic. And we could probably spend hours on this, but hopefully I gave everybody a good enough introduction. And if we have any questions, feel free at this time.
Okay, so if anybody wants to ask a question, there's the chat. Or you could unmute yourself and ask a question. I actually have a question. We have an employee that we let go during the COVID when we did our cutbacks. And they have not really brought back all of the employees now, but he keeps asking when he's going to be brought back, and they don't really want him back. He was like one of those that it was like, he was good, but he was problematic. But they're starting to talk about hiring. He's a salesperson. So they're starting to talk about hiring salespeople. And do we have to hire him back? Or can I hire somebody else?
Well, I don't know that it's a cut and dry question. I think it's going to take looking at the whole situation. If he was, it was a terminating event that occurred because of COVID, right?
Correct.
There was just literally wasn't jobs. And many employers have kind of used it. This is now our opportunity, you know, to really clean house and get the people that we really want. And I think it's sort of a... I think it's a gray area. You need to get legal counsel on it and look at all the surrounding circumstances. It's really a complicated question because it has to do with many facets of how leave was granted, whether those decisions were made properly, whether there was any aspect of what you did before that could be called into question as well, because any of that could make it a complicating issue overall. So I'm sorry if I couldn't give you a definitive answer on that. There are some situations where you may be just fine not hiring back that person because basically it was a termination. And if it was inevitable anyway, I mean, that certainly would help you. If the person had already had multiple write-ups and already, you know, multiple issues, you certainly could, when getting back to the drawing board, could make your decisions on that. But you just have to look at specifically what you want to do, all the various laws that would be potentially impacted. So, yeah, it's really, that's one of those questions. It's a complicated question that can't really be answered in a seminar context.
Okay. Anybody else? No? Okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much. Okay, everybody, we'll see you next month. Thank you, John.
Take care. Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.